For the week of August 9th, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 15, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And outside of Metacritic in New York City, I'm Michael Gill.
Yeah, we're going to have to be a little patient with Michael this week.
Yeah, his internet didn't exactly, I don't know, it's broken. So
Cooperate,
that's a good word. He's actually in New York City, standing on a street corner, trying to find the best cell phone connection he can so he can participate in this week's episode. That's how dedicated he is.
Yeah, and he's going to mute when the sirens go by.
Or come to pick him up.
It's too bad, because we've got a really good show this week. Go, Janine! We're talking about So You Think You Can Dance, the finale. The probability of Paula Abdul leaving American Idol.
Leave American Idol, and I think she very well might join So You Think You Can Dance as a judge.
We'll see. The death of John Hughes and other important dead people. And finish off with a little bit of inside baseball. But we've also got guest Corby Ghosh again today from Corby TV.
That's right. She writes the Corby TV blog on zaptoit.com.
And I want her job.
Yes, I told her that you were very jealous of her. We'll dial her in right after we do the box office. Michael, do you know who won the weekend box office? Since you're standing on a street corner and don't have access to the internet?
Oh, I know the box office. And I helped contribute to that. What was it? $56 million for G.I. Joe. I was there Friday morning at 10:15 a.m. and the place was jammed.
Are you serious? You saw this movie?
I couldn't believe it. I was stunned.
Well, how bad is it?
It's enjoyably bad. I did know a 12-year-old kid who thought it was great, but I think anyone over 12 is going to have trouble with this movie. It's pretty laughable and silly, and I have no idea why Joseph Gordon-Levitt picked this movie to be his, you know, shot at big box office, because it's a stupid, awful role that he's in.
Well, maybe it was his agent or manager that picked it for him.
Oh, well, of course, but eventually he has to say yes, you know.
Yeah, good point.
He doesn't have a manager, but his agent's a pretty decently smart guy. How is Channing Tatum?
Dreadful. He's really, I've sort of liked him okay in a few of the movies. I've given him a lot of slack because he's a nice-looking guy, but boy, this movie proves. It's a terrible movie, though, so you can't really hold someone accountable, but he certainly doesn't hold the screen well, because you can have compelling people in bad action films, but he's bad, and the movie's bad. He has one of the worst lines in the movies. An evil villainess shows up, and Channing Tatum has to admit to the G.I. Joes that he knows her, and he pulls out a photograph and says, "She used to be a blonde."
Oh, no.
He has a photo of her as a blonde. She's now an evil, black-haired villainess.
Well, it was so bad that Paramount Pictures, the studio releasing the film, decided not to show it to critics. Except
that's never a good sign.
That's never a good sign. They did show it to a bunch of fanboy internet sites, so I don't know which sites those are. I know that they showed it to Harry Knowles over at ainitcoolnews.com, and the studio received a lot of flack about that. In fact, so much flack that Joe Morgenstern of the Wall Street Journal went about reviewing the film on Friday, because that's his day to review films for the Wall Street Journal, without having seen the film, and he said so up front.
He took the trailer and just reviewed the entire movie based on the trailer, which it's hysterical.
Right, well, he writes here, but why do I have to see?
Did he like it?
Well, of course not. Of course he didn't. He knew up front.
He didn't not like it. He's very snarky about the whole thing. It's almost irrelevant whether he likes it or not. He explains you don't have to see the movie. There's no sense in reviewing it or even seeing it. Just look at the trailer. You know what you're getting into.
That's right. He says, "Why do I have to see it to review it? People debate the merits of movies they haven't seen all the time, especially on the message boards of the web, where vast numbers of fanboys, apprentice fanatics, and professional grousers turn an endless supply of baseless assumptions into groundless conclusions. At first I felt shut out, but then I realized I was missing the point of a double blessing. Paramount has spared me the pain of sitting through another military toy epic, the recent Transformers sequel having been a near-death experience. And the studio has set me free to reach my own conclusions, not quite groundless, but close, on the basis of the G.I. Joe trailer. These days, not seeing is believing." Times Richard Corliss wrote, he endured a public screening, and then wrote, "As you sit through the movie, you can feel your IQ drop minute by minute."
But what's so funny about about the writer Morgan Stern kind of dissecting the trailer point by point is that he's talking about how he's going to hate this movie just based on the fact that the trailer's got, you know, the Eiffel Tower falling and that, you know, there's this terrible voiceover where the guy mispronounces assembled as assembled, which totally irritated me too. It's just, it's hysterical. I mean, it's true. See the trailer. You don't have to see the movie.
And I do know fanboys who liked the show growing up, and they're annoyed at the film because they give them these sort of Iron Man-like superhero outfits that let them leap through the streets and chase after cars and planes and jump off buildings. And it's, they said, that's not G.I. Joe. That's nothing to do with G.I. Joe. And little did I know, G.I. Joe is an international organization with people from all over the world that fight evil. But apparently they don't have superhero costumes, so even the fanboys are a little annoyed with this movie. And as, like everyone else, I'm sure the movie will drop quite a bit next week. I doubt it will have legs.
Well,
unlike Julie and Julia, which does have legs, thanks to Meryl Streep and Amy Adams.
Right, have you seen that?
I haven't, but I know Meryl Streep. You know, the people who have seen Meryl Streep films are older, and they don't rush out opening weekend, so $20 million is a great opening for her, and if it gets good word of mouth, it could hold very well next week. I'd be surprised if it wasn't, you know, $15, $18 million.
Yeah, she's supposed to be terrific in this, and you can tell just from the trailer that she's fantastic.
Right,
but then Amy Adams gets
the trailer,
kind of,
I would say that I'm not going to love this movie, but it's all right, and Meryl Streep is fun.
Well, that movie made, Julie and Julia, made $20.1 million over the weekend on 2,354 screens, so not bad. As you mentioned, G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra made $56.2 million on 4,007 screens with an average per screen take of $14,025. That's actually pretty good.
Well, it's interesting that Julie and Julia was only on half as many screens and still did pretty well. I mean, it made about, you know, a little less than half the money. That's pretty good.
Yes, indeed. Do you think that Joe Morgenstern should have reviewed this film or talked about this film without having seen it? Joe Morgenstern, mind you, is a great critic. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning critic, and he is a wonderful human being. I mean, he is so nice and in person. He is incredibly smart and a hell of a writer. And so he did this tongue-in-cheek, but do you think he should have done it at all?
I think it's fine. I think he made it very clear from the beginning that he was doing it tongue-in-cheek and that he was reviewing the trailer as it probably, you know, extends to the movie. I think he was pretty upfront about what he was doing. I thought it was funny. I was fine with it.
Now, Michael, do the outlets you write for, would they allow you to do this kind of reviewing without seeing?
As a stunt, you can do it once in a, you know, you can review a movie you walked out of, as long as you let them know you walked out of it. You can review a movie that you didn't see, as long as you're telling them you're reviewing the trailer. And it's just a stunt you can do once every 6 months or a year. It's not something you can make a regular habit of, but it's perfectly fine, especially when they wouldn't let you see it in the first place.
Well, true. Rounding out the box office this weekend was G-Force in number 3, beating out Harry Potter by exactly $1 million. So G-Force made $9.8 million at the box office in its third week, and Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince made $8.8 million in its fourth week. It dropped 50%, while G-Force dropped 44%. Funny People, the Adam Sandler star or vehicle, directed by Judd Apatow, made $7.86 million in its second week on over 3,000 screens. It dropped 65.3%. I have not seen a film with this bad a word of mouth since, I guess G.I. Joe. But I mean, it's got...
No, I agree.
G.I. Joe doesn't have a bad word of mouth yet.
Yeah, it will on Monday.
No, I think it's interesting how fast 20 People has fallen due to word of mouth.
Mm-hmm. That's the real story of the week, I think. I mean, you know, we get caught up in percentage drops, 60%, 65%, 40%. You know, if a movie opens up to 120 million, a 60% drop isn't so bad. But clearly, Funny People came out Friday night and Saturday, they started to stay away, just like they did with Bruno. And by the end of the weekend, the word was out that this wasn't a good movie. Not that it wasn't hilariously funny, because I think people kind of got the idea it wasn't The Last Riot, that it was a little more complex, but Seth Rogen's just not a leading man who can carry a film emotionally, and, you know, it's just not a good movie.
And you said this is the story of the week, Michael. I would say that the story of the week was really Paula Abdul leaving American Idol and letting everybody know by by way of Twitter. We should actually get Corby Ghosh on the phone.
Yeah, let's get Corby on the line. Talk about that. And so you think
of
the dance.
I meant the story of the week via the box office, but I would like to mention that 500 Days of Summer expanded a little bit, 800 screens. It's still booting a little bit, so hopefully Joseph Gordon-Levitt can have a good stir to come out of the summer rather than just G.I. Joe. And Hurt Locker is still doing very well on limited screens. It's fun to see them actually platform a movie for a change.
Oh, Hurt Locker is so good, you have to see that film.
Very good, yeah.
Okay, we now have Corby Ghosh on the line. And Corby, I am saying your name correctly, right?
Perfect.
Yes, and as I mentioned at the top of the show, Corby writes for ZapToIt.com. We will place a link to her blog in the show notes. You can also find her on Twitter. Her handle or screen name or username is at Corby Girl, KORBIGIRL. And, of course, you can see her on Greek coming up and guesting on Scrubs every now and again. She's all over the place, yes.
I'm all over the place. Although Twitter went down this week, it was very frustrating. I haven't tweeted in a few days. I'm getting the shakes.
You can get back on now, I think.
I'm down to tweeting like once a... I post maybe once a day.
I got into it for work. Like, my work made me start, and now I'm addicted to it. It's just a bad habit.
Well, Paula...
No, it's a great habit. Self-promotion. No,
I love it.
Well, it's not only used for self-promotion. Paula Abdul used it this week to let her employers know that she wasn't going to be coming back to... her television show. She sent out a Twitter message, a tweet, as it's been called, and she actually said, that she wasn't coming back to American Idol as a judge.
Yeah.
But I know, Karen, you could care less about that. You just want to talk about you can dance.
No, let's talk about Paula. We can talk about Paula first. It's not that I don't care about the Paula Abdul thing. I just sort of think it's not going to happen that way. I think that it's I hesitate to say publicity stunt, but I'm sort of wondering if this is really the last word. Corby, what do you think?
I think it's right that it's maybe a little bit too early to tell. I'm not saying that I don't believe her. I do think that this is serious, and there's absolutely a good possibility that she won't be back. But, I think maybe it was possibly a bargaining tactic, but... Look, I mean, she's getting all these offers. Yesterday at TCA, the president of ABC, Steve McPherson, said, "We'd love to have her on Dancing with the Stars." Nigel Lithgow from So You Think You Can Dance wants her as well. So she's got a lot of options. Whether that will make Idol, want her even more, I don't know. But
if it's a promotional stunt, I don't think it's a very good one because it's only bringing negative publicity to American Idol. But maybe I'm just annoyed because it seemed like such an idiotic thing that they'd never be dumb enough to do. I mean, if you rank the importance of the people on the show, it's Simon and Paula, and then way below that, Ryan and Randy. I mean, if you're going to play hardball with anyone, it should have been Randy.
Well, and Ryan makes $45 million. Is it per year or per season?
A three-year deal, $15 million a year.
They were offering Paula Abdul, I think it was $6 million is what she got paid this year, and they were offering her $4 million per year for a $16 million.
No. Yeah, it was she was making two, according to the New York Times, she was making $2 million a year, and they offered her a 30% raise, which would raise it to $2.6 million, a four-year deal worth $10 million. Okay. That's what the New York Times said a day or two ago.
Okay, that's what it was then. Just goes to show you should never listen to me when it comes to American Idol. I have no idea what I'm talking about.
Well, Corby, do you think that what is an American Idol like without Paula?
It's not the same show. It's just not the same show. Frankly, I think a lot of people tune in because they like the banter between Simon and Paula. Without her there, it's going to be a completely different dynamic. They threw Cara DiGuardi in this year. She was not well received by the fans overall. And it shows that you can't just have anyone on that panel. And she's not, I mean, Paula is not, I don't think... I don't think they realize that. I think maybe they think, oh, we just need Simon and some other chick. That's not how it works. I guess I just heard that, Posh Spice went in to be a guest judge. Certainly she has a high profile and people are interested in her and she sells magazines. But the word is that she was terrible on the panel, that she came off cold, that she was trying too hard to be nice, and it just didn't work. And again, another example, you can't just have anyone on that panel.
Now, I'm always saying that I think that this is really sexist. What do you think about that?
I agree. It's the eighth year of the number one show on television. It's been number one for 5 years in a row, I believe, now. And 2.6 million for however many episodes they do in that 4 months is about 30 episodes. That's like fourth or fifth banana on a sitcom, you know, this long into a show's run. It's just to pay her that much less than Ryan and Simon. I haven't heard any figures on Randy. It's just unbelievable.
They get, or maybe Paula gave off the impression that she could be walked all over because she's not as, you know, strong of a personality. Of course, now I'm just guessing and I'm making assumptions, but, you know, because maybe she doesn't come off as such a strong personality like Simon, they think that they could walk all over her. I don't know if that's the case. It seems that way.
Like what you said about they just think they need Simon and some chick. I totally agree with you on that.
Yeah.
A lot of entertainment journalists started talking about the fact that Ryan Seacrest is making 45, Simon is obviously making in the hundreds of millions, and that Randy Jackson is supposedly somewhere around the $30 million level. Why is it that Paula isn't in the same range of at least Randy Jackson? I would have to agree, unless they're trying to punish her for some reason.
She just had a great season, I think. I think they're bringing in Kara did wake her up a bit. She was really focused. She had a really good season. There have been some reports of internal strife with them bringing in some stalker to the show and letting that person audition when Paula said she didn't want them to, and they deny that. And this is the woman who died outside her home,
right,
and
yeah,
some other things. But I'm sorry, it's a hit show. It's the number one show. You don't care about that internal stuff. You do what you can to keep your top three, four people on the show. And there's no reason she's worth less money than the others. I mean, Simon is a producer. He made the show happen back in England, so that's why he makes such a different level of money. And he was the first breakout star. And Ryan does a lot of stuff, but there's no way she's not close to Ryan and certainly equal to Randy.
Well, I know that when a show is that popular, they say don't break the formula, don't mess with the formula. And it looks like they are allowing, I mean, if you read what Peter Rice said at the TCAs, which are the Television Critic Association press tour, Peter Rice, the head of the chairman of Fox now, he's basically saying it's too bad, but Paul is gone. And it looks as if there's early speculation that she will wind up on So You Think You Can Dance, which is a show I know, Corby, you and Karen love.
Go, Janine!
Are you excited about Janine? I am too. I love Janine from the beginning, from the very, very beginning. I noticed her. She wasn't, and I think everyone has been said a lot. There weren't any big stars or people that stood out this year. But I liked Janine from the very beginning. I met her a couple days before they announced the top 20. And in person, she just came off as a very sweet, down-to-earth person. But on the show, that first week when her and Philip teamed up, I mean, I was screaming in that hip-hop number. And after that, I mean, she just has a precision and a grace and a level of skill and mixed with a great personality. I loved her from the start. And it's nice to see.
I absolutely agree. I had a girl crush on her. I mean, I just thought she was talented and funny and clearly popular among the other dancers. She was a star from the very beginning who was held back, I think, by Philip, who I also liked but didn't have any skills, technical skills. Was held back by him, I thought, for a long time.
Now, for our listeners, or myself, So You Think You Can Dance is a reality show. It airs on ABC, is it?
Fox.
Okay.
Same production company as Idol.
Okay, so it airs on Fox. And what is the point of the show? What is the game behind the show? It's
American Idol for dancers.
Okay, so Jeannie is her name?
Janine.
Shows you how much I watch television. Janine, so she won this week?
Yes.
How long was the show on before she won?
They started showing auditions, I believe, in May. Yes,
yeah,
right after Idol ended. And so the auditions went on into June, and early June they started the top 20, which is, you know, they pick 20 dancers, 10 women, 10 men, pair them up into couples, and then they compete every week with different choreographers, you know, choreography against each other. And the winner was crowned on Thursday.
Well, I know this wasn't the first season. How many seasons has it been on?
This is the fifth season. They just had their 100th episode, actually, which, you know, they did that whole publicity thing of having Katie Holmes on to dance and Ellen DeGeneres judge that week. So it's been on quite a while.
I'm just looking over my notes here to see if there's any more inane questions about So You Think You Can Dance that make me look
like
an idiot.
I've got a couple of questions. Did you think that Jeanette was robbed?
I love Jeanette. I think she was a great dancer. I thought, just like Debbie Allen said, that this year, this is the strongest group of women the show has ever seen. Skill-wise, I thought they were all fantastic. And the thing about Jeanette was that she also, like Janine, had the personality as well as, you know, she being a very skilled dancer. I don't know if she was robbed. I mean, I do think she probably should have been in the final four.
Nigel actually said that the night that Jeanette was kicked off, he said he was disappointed because the young lady that he thought should have won was kicked off.
Yeah. Yeah, he flat out said he thought she should have won, which is funny because during the early weeks of the show, they were all about Kayla, which I think actually maybe hurt Kayla because people were like, what's so great about Kayla? You know, it was like early on, it was even though Kayla, who did end up in the final four, was a fantastic dancer, I don't think she had the personality or the likability.
She was cold, very cold.
Yeah, totally. And by the way, in person too.
And yet, you go on the website, there's a video of her that says, I think I've got star quality. I just disagree with you, Kayla. I really don't think you do.
Do these people have last names?
Oh, boy. But, yes, you know, the judges were all about her. I mean, all about her. They just talked her up so much to the point where I think maybe the public was like, I don't get it.
We know the success all the Idol finalists have had, the people in the top 10 in movies and television and Broadway and music, obviously. What's been the track record for the dancers who've won So You Think You Can Dance? I know some of them have come back onto the show as choreographers, but beyond the universe of the show, have they gotten leading roles in Broadway shows, or what's happened to them?
I can answer that question, actually. In fact, for the 100th episode, I did a whole feature for Yahoo.com on where the alumni from the show have gone. And even though they're not necessarily as high profile as the Idol alumni, they are doing a lot of great things. I don't know. Actually, there could be a really big breakout star, depending on how well Fame does. You know, the highly anticipated movie that's, I think, opening in September. One of last year's finalists, Carrington, got a lead role in that. So that's going to be coming out in the fall.
And I hear she's a breakout from that movie. I hear she's fantastic.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it. I mean, she was great on the show. I think she made the top six last year. So that's very cool. And then Adam Shankman, who's a choreographer and a judge on the show, and who obviously is a director of a ton of movies, including Hairspray, and what else has he directed?
The Wedding Planner?
I don't know if he did The Wedding Planner, did he? He's directing Step Up 3D, which is coming out either later this year or early next year. And there's 5 alumni from So You Think You Can Dance in roles on that. A couple of them have been nominated, or actually just one has been nominated for an Emmy. Like you said, they've come back as choreographers on the show. And one of them is up for an Emmy right now for choreographing a couple dancers last year. Yeah, so they're doing various things. I think there's a couple that are doing Broadway shows in New York right now. And they're not recording artists, they're dancers, and dancers by definition are usually in the background.
Well, one, Travis Wall came back and did, you know, a couple of what I thought were fantastic pieces. I thought that dance he did with Janine and Jason was just my favorite of the season.
Yeah, it was unbelievable.
And Travis Wall was the runner-up from season 2 when Benji Schwimmer inexplicably won.
What I've noticed based on your talking about this is that none of the contestants have last names until after they're off the show.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
You go by their first names, and then once they're gone or win, then they can use both their names.
That's true.
There's some truth to that, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, talking about American Idol and So You Think You Can Dance or any reality show really makes me feel like a real idiot, as you can probably tell from the stupid questions I ask. But, you know, I just don't watch these types of shows. I know, Corby, you write about them all the time because I read about them on your blog all the time, and I've also been reading a little bit about what you were up to this week, and I know you're going to have to leave us soon because you've been extremely busy with the Television Critic Association press tour, which was happening in Pasadena for the past 2 weeks. Was there anything coming out of that that was especially notable?
Yeah, I've been crazy busy with that, and actually I'm so behind on TV, I almost feel the same as you. My DVR is at 100%, and I feel like I'm behind on a lot of stuff because I've been there all week.
Wait. Which one of your four DVRs is at 100%?
All of them. I'm way behind. It's good, you know, at TV Critics Press Tour, the networks roll out all of their new shows for the critics to get to know, and some of their old shows. And I think people should be excited about a couple things. Definitely Modern Family on ABC, which is the show that is starring Ed O'Neill, Julie Bowen, who was on Lost, a couple of other names that, I don't know, I guess aren't as high profile, but you'll recognize their faces because they've done a lot of other TV stuff. But anyway, it's about three couples, one non-traditional, it's like one gay couple, one traditional couple, and then one like second marriage type thing, step family type thing. And it's just really funny. I mean, laugh out loud funny. There's not a lot of great comedies on right now. This is going to be one of them. Also on NBC Community with Chevy Chase and Joel McHale, the pilot is very, very funny.
Oh, the pilot is so funny.
Isn't it great?
Oh, it was one of the few like pilots, you know, comedy pilots that I just laughed out loud.
Yep. It's been a long time since that's happened. I'm excited for that one.
What about Mercy? The trailers are pretty good.
Yeah, Mercy's okay. I didn't love it, but it definitely has potential. So we'll see. That's the one with Michelle Trachtenberg, who people know from Buffy, and she's also on Gossip Girl, playing a guest role, Georgina. But yeah, that is that's about nurses, and it's a look at a hospital from the nurse's perspective, which we've been seeing a lot of lately.
Those
actually,
shows,
but
or what?
It was a new thing up until this year.
And what about the ABC show Flash Forward?
Flash Forward is also going to be a breakout hit, I think. Flash Forward is, the network is sort of billing it as their new Lost. It's not exactly like Lost. It doesn't have as rich and complicated of a mythology, which thank God for that, I'm happy to say. But it does have, you know, sort of like a mystery behind the whole, not sort of, there is a mystery behind the whole plot and the whole, you know, arc of the season. And there's a lot of different characters. It's a huge ensemble cast. There will be, little clues and Easter eggs throughout, you know, the episodes all throughout the season. So it's good. I saw the pilot, which ABC did not send out screeners for. They didn't put it online. It was one of the only shows they didn't because, they're worried about spoilers and piracy and all that kind of stuff. They're being very protective of the show. They're really excited about it.
They sure have been marketing the heck out of it, though.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And their marketing campaign for it is, I think, somewhat effective. They show you these little blips and flashes as a commercial. They're like, I don't even think they're a second long. And they're really tiny on the screen. And then they ask, what did you see? Or something to that effect.
Yes. Because the premise of the show is that, you know, some sort of life is normal. You know, people are going about their day as usual. Then all of a sudden, some sort of catastrophe happens. No one knows what it is. But in that moment, everyone gets a glimpse into their future. And some people like what they see in their future, some people don't. But all of a sudden, then they're back in present day. They're dealing with the aftermath of this catastrophe. What was it? And all of the emotions that come from what they saw in their future.
Yeah,
that's fine to me, but if we have to spend 5 seasons with the whole idea being, I wonder whether their future will come true or whether they can change it, I'm going to get tired of it pretty quick.
Agreed.
I don't know. We didn't, that with that kind of thing with Lost, really. I mean,
but that was
Lost a lot of its audience. Lost, I stopped watching it, and a lot of people have. It's way down in viewership from where it was. It definitely lost a lot of viewers. So did Heroes. You just can't drag this stuff out too much. You know, I can't turn a miniseries into a 5-year-old show.
You know, I realized this week as I was trying to catch up on Prison Break that I didn't see a single episode from the 4th season.
Trying to catch up on Prison Break?
Yes, that's a show I do watch.
That's a lonely job. I stopped watching in season 2 when they got thrown back into another prison and had to break out of that one.
I watched it, but come on, Sperling. Trying to catch up on Prison Break. It like went off the air like last year.
Well, I did just see the last episode of Lost, I think, 2 weeks ago. My DVR was at 100% for quite some time.
Yeah.
Well, Corby, you've had a chance to look at all, probably most of the pilots of the networks, and when I've done that, I know it's usually true that 90% of them just seem god-awful bad. Is that sort of the, maybe 1 out of 10 looks like it might be okay, is that sort of the ratio this year, or does the crop look slightly stronger or weaker to you?
Yeah, no, I mean, there have certainly been years where there's nothing I care about at all. This year is better than, you know, the average in that there are 4 or 5 things that I'm excited about, including, you know, Glee, which premiered after Idol, but technically it's not really starting until the fall. Flash Forward, which we just spoke about, Community, and Modern Family.
Was there anything, Corby, from the TCA press tour, any big star moments? Because the networks bring out many of the stars from these shows to talk to the press. Was there any specific memorable star moment?
Not really, honestly. It's not like Comic-Con where it's so, you know, the fandom is so overwhelming and exciting. The critics in TCA are very, you know, subdued. They try to be very professional and, you know, not get too excited about things. And also, you know, I don't know if there's any, like, big, huge stars that that really made a splash this year. And, of course, we're used to seeing them every year. It is nice, though, to see Joseph Fiennes, who we all know from film, is doing Flash Forward. He's the lead in it. So it was kind of cool to welcome him into the TV world. And he seems to be a lovely person. I got to interview him yesterday, and very down-to-earth and nice.
There was a lot of press about what Kelsey Grammer, the actor, had to say about the Fox network. Were you there for that?
You know what? I was not there for that because during ABC's day, because Kelsey Grammer's on a new ABC show called Hank, during ABC's day, I was in the back doing one-on-one interviews with everyone. So while the panels were going on, I was actually, you know, in a room waiting for the stars to come in one by one and get video interviews. So I wasn't in that panel. Yeah, what did he say?
I don't know. I read a headline that Kelsey Grammer digs into Fox. Were you there for the Fox panel?
I was there for some of them, not all of them.
And was there a lot of discussion about the American Idol hubbub with Paula Abdul?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was really, that was the big news of the week, of course, to have press tour right after that. And I think the general consensus among everyone is, what is Fox thinking? Like, this is ridiculous.
How do you and Karen think Paula would fit onto So You Think You Can Dance or Dancing with the Stars? Do you see her on the panel, and who should they get rid of, or how would she do?
No, I think she'd be okay as a guest judge on So You Think You Can Dance, but they've already got their wacko and Mary Murphy.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. You never know what the chemistry, I think, is going to be like until you see it, until it's there. She might be fine, but she might be great, you know. She certainly has the credentials. She certainly is deserving to be on any panel, I think, but especially if she does what she did this year on Idol, which, you know, you were saying earlier, she totally stepped up her game and was, you know, and had a great season. It was valuable, giving commentary that was, you know, worthwhile every week. And
now, when you were last here on episode 12, you mentioned that you were going to Comic-Con for the first time, and I was wondering what you thought of it.
Honestly, I ended up having a really good time. It was a lot of fun. I was very nervous about going. I didn't want to work over the weekend, and B was just, you know, I had heard a lot of horror stories about, you know, the crazy, insane fans and, you know, getting trampled, trying to get into panels and having to sleep outside, you know, to get into certain things. And you know, I didn't have to do any of that, although it certainly happened. I got pictures of all the lost fans waiting in line, sleeping over on the grass the night before. So, and of course, the Twihards, as you call them, did the same. I mean, thousands and thousands of people in sleeping bags overnight. It was a crazy sight to see, but it was really cool. And the nice thing about Comic-Con is that, you know, here when you go to parties like TCA parties, you know, the actors and the producers are there, and they're certainly accessible. You know, the parties are, it's all open bar, and everyone food, and it's supposed to be a good time, but they know that they're working, and a lot of times they have to be on set the next day, so they're not really having a good time. At Comic-Con, they're partying. They're usually celebrating. They're coming down to San Diego for basically 2 hours of work. doing a panel where they feel like rock stars because their biggest fans are just screaming at the top of their lungs, you know, filling an auditorium, thousands of people who think they're amazing. And then they go and they do press for about an hour. And then the rest of the, you know, the weekend is theirs. And you go to parties, there's fantastic parties at night, and they really are celebrating. It was, you know, it was a really good time. I actually had a really funny experience. Joss Whedon, of course, is the creator of Buffy and Dollhouse.
And Firefly.
Couldn't get into a party on Friday night. It was fantastic. I left the Warner Brothers party. There was a lot of the cast of Chuck and Big Bang Theory there, and they were like, hey, we're going to this Wrath of Khan party. You know, you should come. I wasn't credentialed for it, but I was like, let's just go and see. Maybe I can get in. I get there, and Joss Whedon's standing outside with two of the cast members from Dollhouse, not able to get into the party. And we were like, what are you doing? And
Joss was like, what cast members was he with?
We're waiting to get in. I was like, what do you mean you're waiting to get in? Like, knowing full well all of the other... I mean, I knew so many people that were up in the party. Joss Whedon's like the king of Comic-Con, and he can't get in.
It was great.
The bouncers wouldn't let him in. At one point, people were recognizing him. He was signing autographs and taking pictures with fans outside, and he never did get into that party.
He didn't scream, do you know who I am? I'm the king of
Comic-Con!
That's
what we asked him. We asked him, "Why did you pull the 'Do you know who I am?'" And he was like, "I don't think I know who I am."
Aww,
he's so great. And you know what? I saw him the next night on the red carpet for the Sci-Fi EW party, and I said to him, "You know, you never did get in." He said, "No, we never did." But it was great. We went to another bar and we had a dance party. We had so much fun. And I said, you gotta have a dance party tonight. Are you gonna go up in this party, have a dance party? He's like, yeah, maybe we're talking about it. I was like, you have to. And lo and behold, I went up to the party later, and Joss was dancing. And he got the whole, I mean, he made the dance floor. There was no dance floor. But we had a dance party with Joss Whedon. He's a great guy. I mean, he's just totally down to earth and cool. And yes, I became a bigger fan that night.
More importantly, did you wear the I Am a Comic-Con Virgin t-shirt?
Oh, yeah!
I did not. I refrained from getting into that business.
Well, on episode 13, when we had our Comic-Con panel on, I asked if anybody had seen someone wearing that shirt, and they were all shaking their head. They had not seen anybody, so...
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe we should start a line of t-shirts and sell them down at Comic-Con. I think we'd probably make a lot of money.
Well, that's where that's one of the big money makers down there in San Diego each year is t-shirts.
Is it?
Well, I know that I've seen a couple of people walking around with t-shirts from Comic-Con. One said Flynn Lives, which was a Tron shirt. There was a whole group of t-shirts that I saw coming out of Comic-Con.
Oh, cool.
Well, certainly, I hope you recover from the TCA press tour. It's 2 weeks long, isn't it?
Yeah, 2 weeks, cable. I mean, we went from Comic-Con right into cable, TCA, and then network was this week. So you can tell I'm kind of losing my voice. I've been burning the candle at both ends.
Well, we really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us about what happened at the TCAs and your thoughts on the Paula Abdul Leaving American Idol story, as well as the So You Think You Can Dance finale, especially myself, because I don't know a thing about these shows. Karen on the other hand, and Michael, they're experts.
I'm totally obsessed.
I love it. That's great. Thanks for having me. I always have a good time. It's fun.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. She really sounds like she has been worked quite hard over the last couple of weeks.
I still want her life.
Yes. We know. I guess technically then Corby has a stalker.
Yes, in me. That's correct.
Well,
although the TCAs kind of suck. They're a lot of work.
They are a lot of work, and it's not something... I've done them once, and I decided that was enough television coverage for me. I went right back to film.
No, I did them once, and I love TV, but at the end, I was just like, no more TV for me. Uh-uh. That lasted an hour. So let's move on to other headlines.
Well, other headlines are all in the film world. The other big headlines of the week were... They're different headlines, but effectively they mean the same thing, and that is it wasn't a very good week for filmmakers and screenwriters. John Hughes, the filmmaker and writer behind 16 Candles, The Breakfast Club, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, the 80s Brat Pack movie king, passed away due to a heart attack at the age of 59.
Heart attack while running.
I thought he was sightseeing in New York.
Somebody told me he was running.
Either way, he passed away.
He's dead.
He died. Yeah. Which is a shame.
He, like, was my, like, teenage years. I mean, 16 Candles, Pretty in Pink. I mean, some of the best movies ever are his.
Pretty in Pink was my first celebrity interview. I interviewed John Cryer when I was 14 or 15. No, actually, I was 16 years old when I interviewed John Cryer for a magazine for that film. And I just remember
what
that.
What magazine? What are you, working for Entertainment Weekly?
No, it was called The Teenage View.
How cute.
Was a magazine for teenagers by teenagers around the entertainment world. So I guess I haven't really moved much in my 30-some-odd years since then.
You knew what you wanted to do as a teenager.
What I found interesting about John Hughes was he died, and people looked back over his work and went, you know, actually, there isn't that much there. You know, he had that very brief period where he was focused on teen movies, and he's probably the only filmmaker I can think of who's really known for that world, that genre of type of movie focusing on teenagers. And then he just stopped, really. You know, then he just wrote for a while, and then he just stopped completely. He hasn't done anything in movies in a decade or more, you know. Occasional old scripts would surface somewhere, but, you know, he got bored with directing, then he got bored with writing.
Well, I agree with you, and I don't know whether it was the fact that he's been gone for nearly 12 or 14 years, that nobody had a very good obituary for John Hughes, or the fact that he passed away unexpectedly at a relatively young age. He was 59. He hadn't even turned 60 yet. I have not read a good obituary on John Hughes yet, though I will say Patrick Goldstein's article in the Los Angeles Times in the Big Picture column, John Hughes' Secret Pen Pal Reveals Why He Left Hollywood Behind, is absolutely fantastic. And he goes on to talk about a woman named Allison Byrne Field, who is a Washington-based social media strategy director, who on her own blog talked about how for 2 years in the mid-1980s, she was John Hughes' pen pal. And it didn't start out that way. She actually sent him a letter, a very heartfelt long letter, and then he sent her back a form letter. She then was so upset with him that she wrote back, and she wrote, quote, "I just poured out my expletive heart to you," and in capital letters, she writes, "You sent me a form letter." And
I think that's hysterical. Good for her.
Hughes wrote back to apologize, but in 1987, when she didn't hear from Hughes for a few months, Fields tracked down producer Ned Tannen, telling him she hoped he could give the filmmaker a quote-unquote poke and figure out why he wasn't responding. Instead of dismissing her as a pushy teenager, Hughes sent her a giant gift package of t-shirts, tapes, and her own special Ferris Bueller's Day Off watch, with a note saying, "I missed you too. Don't get me in trouble with my boss, John Hughes."
I think that's adorable.
But and why did she say that he left the industry?
Well, she goes on to talk about, according to Patrick Goldstein, again, of the LA Times, he says, here, John told Allison about why he left Hollywood just a few years earlier. He was terrified of the impact it was having on his sons. He was scared. It was going to cause them to lose perspective on what was important and what happiness meant. And he told me a sad story about how a big reason behind his decision to give it all up was what, quote-unquote, they, meaning Hollywood, had killed his friend John Candy by greedily working him too hard. Fields writes in her blog that Hughes took time to make a little girl believe that if she had something to say, someone would listen. And Goldstein goes on to write, "It's hard to ask for a better tribute to a man who didn't just make wonderful movies, but lived a wonderful life, too." And I'd have to agree. I mean, it was a very touching story.
I thought it was really interesting what he said about why he left. And that, you know, how it was affecting his family. And I just, wow. I mean, what somebody who really had their priorities in order. I mean, arguably, I mean, some people would say that family doesn't necessarily have to be your top priority, but I just thought that was really wonderful.
Well, I know it's the reason that Ron Howard moved his family to Connecticut.
Yeah, you want to keep them family, but that's very nice. But it doesn't, I would disagree with the idea that he made wonderful movies. I mean, I loved that batch of movies when I was a kid, but other than The Breakfast Club, I think Pretty in Pink is problematic. Half the movie has that horrifically embarrassing Asian stereotypes. I'm not Pretty in Pink, but 16 Candles. Pretty in Pink is a little sketchy. Ferris Bueller, half the stuff with the school teacher being slapsticky, trying to break into the home is stupid. You know, there's just not that very much good work there. I think his biggest talent is finding young stars. That, to me, is his big accomplishment. I mean, Andrew McCarthy, James Spader, everybody in the Breakfast Club. It's a pretty strong group of talent that he brought to attention.
He also was absolutely fantastic at picking music for his movies. His soundtracks were actually...
I disagree. Two songs. You got The Simple Minds, Don't You Forget About Me, and Psychedelic Furs. Other than that, those soundtracks are mostly crappy.
I disagree. I think he tapped into a whole genre that nobody else really had. I mean, as much as they say, you know, like The Outsiders and movies like that, I mean, John Hughes movies really spoke to teenagers. Whether they were good or bad is almost irrelevant. He tapped into, you know, a feeling from them that, like The Breakfast Club exemplifying that, that, you know, really hadn't been done.
And
but, you know, all of his movies, when you look back on them, like Breakfast Club and not Pretty in Pink, but certainly Ferris Bueller, sort of like it's that old, the parents, it's all the parents' fault. If you're unhappy, it's because you've got mean, awful parents. You just need to trash dad's car, or it's all the folks, you know, blame it all on the parents. It's sort of a thin little trope that he keeps going back to again and again.
Yeah, but you're coming at that from an adult's perspective. If you're watching a movie like that as a teenager, it is your parents' fault.
That's true, but the movies just, that means they may not hold up well. I mean, there are movies you can like as a kid that don't hold up well later. I think Breakfast Club
holds
up
well.
I think
I can watch all these movies today and enjoy them just as much.
Really? Long Dong and 16 Candles and the
yes,
cymbal clashing every time he walks
absolutely.
On screen?
Jake is still the ultimate man.
Well, Matthew Broderick in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, when he joins the parade and sings Twist and Shout, so yet another example of John Hughes'
music. Out of the 30, 40 movies he made, yes, those three are the ones that stand out.
What's interesting about Ferris Bueller is that you will watch that movie now, and when I watched it at the time, I thought Ferris Bueller was the coolest thing ever, the actual guy. But when you watch the movie now, you realize that Ferris Bueller was actually kind of a jerk. Totally took advantage of his popularity and his friends and was incredibly selfish. He's actually not a very nice guy.
Hold on, I'm just writing that down. Ferris Bueller was a jerk. I think that's our title. You know,
it's true. I mean, he pushes his friend in ways that are a little uncomfortable. And his poor little sister, she has a great scene with Charlie Sheen, but she's like, why is Ferris always get away with everything?
That was her best movie, I think. Even better than
Dirty Dancing, Jennifer
Dirty Dancing. She was fantastic in this movie.
Well,
but she, you watch it again, and she is the one whose side you're on. Like, I watched Ferris Bueller, and I can't stand Ferris. I can't stand him. Such a jerk.
Well, you know, the movie that really allowed John Hughes to retire from Hollywood was one that we haven't even mentioned. Home Alone.
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles?
No, Home Alone.
Home Alone.
He wrote that movie.
Another not very good movie.
Well, they're not. And you know what?
The biggest comedy hit of all time when it was released.
Maybe that disheartened him. Maybe he knew that they weren't very good movies, and yet they were just phenomenal, like record breakers. Maybe he just became disillusioned.
I remember in 1990, standing on a street corner in New York City, I was working for 20th Century Fox at the time, trying to give away tickets to a press screening of Home Alone. And people walking by were like, I don't want to see that movie. That looks stupid. And it went on to become this huge hit.
Yeah. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles was actually my first press conference, my first press junket. They flew me out to Hollywood from my college in Gainesville, Florida. So I have fond memories for that. And it's not a bad movie except for the sentimental ending. But that was a film where he tried to broaden out into more adult terrain. And it was fairly successful, but he just couldn't keep going. You know, like Judd Apatow is doing today, perhaps. He couldn't build on that and expand into adult films or something other than the teen movies that we all kept wanting to keep making.
Well, another filmmaker, or I should say screenwriter, that passed away this week was Bud Schulberg, who died at the age of 95. So that's why a lot of people were questioning why his obituary was on the front page of both the Los Angeles Times and the New York Times and Variety. But he was, in his day, a very important writer and a very important author.
I always wonder what made him run.
Funny. What Michael is referring to, for those of you who might not be up on your Bud Schulberg, is Bud Schulberg was the son of a Hollywood tycoon, one of the first moguls of Hollywood, named B.P. Schulberg, who ran Paramount Studios. And so he grew up in Hollywood, in Hancock Park, with all of these celebrities walking through his house. Charlie Chaplin, Marlena Dietrich, they would come to parties at his house. And he grew up and he wrote a book called What Makes Sammy Run. And it was by far what he was known for the most. Sammy, the title character, was Sammy Glick, who was a cutthroat, claw-your-way-to-the-top Hollywood executive. And it is the, I guess, he is the progenitor of, he is the...
The rapacious agent?
Yeah, he is the mold to which all other on-screen agents have been likened to. So whether it was in Robert Altman's The Player, or whether it's the main character of Entourage, whose name...
Ari,
yes, thank you. I was going to say Ari Emanuel.
After Ari Emanuel, hello, Ari Gold.
Ari Gold, they all pretty much go back to Sammy Glick. And so he started that. He kind of was a little reticent at having turned somebody that he himself thought was a horrible person into somebody that is now idolized. It's not bad to be Sammy Glick now.
Whereas, idolized? Who idolizes him? He's
agents.
Not idolized. What makes Sammy Run isn't a portrait of a guy you're supposed to think is wonderful.
No, but
if you are an agent, it is.
Right, correct.
No, I don't think they say this is a role model. They may act like him, but I don't think people read the book and think, yes, that's the man.
That's the whole thing. None of them have read the book, but they hear of Sammy Glick and they think of him as being like this uber agent, like the Mike Ovitz of his day. So it's almost irrelevant whether who Sammy Glick really was. It's who Sammy Glick has become in their own head.
You know,
so they got coverage on the book.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. They got coverage on the book.
They just got the notes from the book. Well, you know, his father...
Well, I interviewed Ben Stiller once, and that was a dream project of his that he tried to get made for years, a feature film version of What Makes Sammy Run.
Right. He actually had Bud Schulberg's blessing to go and do it because he felt like Ben Stiller was one of the best people to do that type of movie. Schulberg's father, however, told him not to publish it because, quote, he would never work in Hollywood again. But what's interesting to me is the life that Schulberg led. It's so fascinating. I mean, this is a guy that was, when he wrote a really bad script, the head of the studio came in and said, I want you to work with another writer. And he said, well, you know, which writer? And the studio head said, F. Scott Fitzgerald. And Schulberg turns around and says, F. Scott Fitzgerald, isn't he dead? He said, dead. He's sitting in the other room. And so he basically tells all of these wonderful stories about working with F. Scott Fitzgerald. It didn't work out too well, and he then wrote a book about it called The Disenchanted, which was turned into a play. But it's his stories are fascinating, and the New York Times has... They're doing something that's either incredibly morbid or really just... it should be commended. But they have this series called The Last Word. And what they do is they interview... people like Art Buchwald and Bud Schulberg and others before they pass away, and they will only play these edited videos about these people talking about their history and their life after they pass away. So this week, of course, they were running the one they did with Bud Schulberg, and I was going to watch 2 minutes of it. It was a 20-minute video. I wound up watching the whole thing. It was that fascinating.
So what, somebody hits 90 and they decide it's time to interview them or what?
Yep, exactly.
That's exactly it.
Hey, you look like you might die. Can we talk to you?
It's kind of it's kind of creepy because they're talking about themselves as if they've died at times. The best one.
But you know, they all have to deal with people from the Times who come to them. The New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times. They come to them and say, hi, I'd love to do a chat with you for just a profile for our files. And they know what's going on. They know it's the obit chat where they're doing a follow-up interview and getting quotes and getting information for the obituary that will run maybe 10 years, 15 years down the road. But they know there's no article coming out of it, that they're being interviewed for their obituary, no matter how they try to word it. So these people have dealt with this for decades. It's just now they film it and say, we'll put this up after you die. and they do it with the smart, funny people like Art Buchwald who get it and say, okay, great, that'll be fun.
Well, yeah, Art Buchwald was a fun interview because... his video opens with, if you're watching this, then I'm dead.
Ouch.
It's just typical Art Buchwald humor. This one was a little bit drier and a little bit more like a real documentary. And what's interesting is that Schulberg worked with Fitzgerald in the 30s. He then went and wrote What Makes Sammy Run in 1941 after he worked with Fitzgerald. And after that, He actually participated in World War II and was one of the people that went and arrested German filmmaker Leni Riefenstahl and brought her to Nuremberg, which I did not know. He then joined...
Boy, was she talented.
Well, he then was one of the members of Hollywood that had joined the Communist Party, and he did it for 6 years until after What Makes Sammy Run was published. He thought that maybe they had a good idea going, because in the 30s, of course, America was going through a time much like today that was very economically tough, and the rich were getting a little bit wealthier while the poor were really, really hurting. Nobody had a job. The Great Dust Bowl time. And so he thought, well, maybe this is one ideology that might work. 6 years later, after What Makes Sammy Run was published and they turned on him, he realized, well, they don't believe in freedom of speech any more than our own government. So he left them. And he was then brought in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee, the Joe McCarthy hearings, in 1951. And he actually was one of those, along with Elijah Kazan and others, who named names. He actually named a few people who were in the Communist Party with him. And he really felt like, well, look, the Communist Party had turned on me. They weren't my friends anymore. So I just did what I had to do to survive. And that that was actually one of the things that, you know, stands out in his life, is that he did that.
Well, and that led to, of course, on the waterfront, one of Elie Kazan and Bud Schulberg's most famous films, which I've always found fascinating, that Hollywood embraces, because it's literally a movie about defending yourself for ratting out your friends and how you have to do it because you realize they're bad people. And it's very clear that that's what it's an allegory for, and I never quite understood why Hollywood embraced it, because they were despised for many years for what they did.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when Elijah Kazan got that honorary Oscar a few years back, I mean, there were boos when he took the stage.
Oh, didn't you see Ed Harris and his wife? She won the... What's her name?
They were scowling with crossed arms.
They were sitting there glowering with their arms crossed. It was awesome. They were so angry.
Well, Schulberg is a writer who was prolific. He was working right up until the very end, writing a screenplay with Spike Lee on the heavyweight title fight between Joe Louis, the black American champion, and Max Schmeling, the German boxer, which took place, I believe, in the 30s, right leading up to World War II. And he was writing biographies, and he wrote for Vanity Fair, and he really wrote quite a bit, and his mind was really, really sharp right up to the very end. One of the best articles I read about him was actually written in 2005. It was a huge, long profile that's well worth reading. And Karen, I'm reading this quote for you because I think you'd enjoy it. He starts talking about Goldstein, that is. He starts talking about and writing about all of the people that are now viewed as Sammy Glicks. Jeffrey Katzenberg, for instance, was referred to as a Sammy Glick. He writes about Brett Ratner here. He says, when Brett Ratner was campaigning for the job of directing the film The Family Man, he arrived 20 minutes late for a meeting with producer Mark Abraham. He then quotes Abraham as saying, he was with a model who was not his girlfriend and was twice as tall as he is, talking on a cell phone with another ringing in his pocket, Abraham recalled. When the producer told him that if he took another call, he'd lose the job, one of his phones kept going off, and watching Brett not answer it was like watching a drug addict at a party trying to walk by a mound of cocaine without stopping.
God, can you? I almost worked for Brett Ratner. Dodged a bullet on that one.
Well, I know. This is actually a very good point to segue into our final story, which, of course, is always Inside Baseball.
Inside Baseball!
The stories that only the people in Hollywood either know about or care about, but... Schulberg was definitely known for writing about an inside Hollywood player. And this week, you wrote a story on Industry Nexus, which can be found at industrynexus.com, about saving the William Morris Endeavor, or whatever they're called now, assistants.
WME assistants.
WME assistants. Now, you and I both worked at William Morris, not Endeavor. We worked there together at the same time, which is how we met. We weren't paid very well. I think we were paid $350 a week.
We paid $350 a week, but that's was only part of what my piece was about. Was that, well, first of all, we were paid $350 a week. I mean, it was paid, like, it was a weekly thing, and now they're all paid hourly. And I can't figure out. I'm sure that there is some kind of a catch there, and that it helps the agencies somehow not have to pay out something, but hourly. I don't get it.
Well, you know what it is? It's that it's overtime after normal work hours. So if your work hours are 9 to 7, and you work 9 to 7. Then there's no overtime. You work 9 to 8, then you get 1 hour of overtime.
Well, yeah, but still, these kids are paid you know, $13 an hour or whatever.
$13 an hour at the high end.
At the high end. But just the fact that they're breaking it down by an hour. But, I mean, what surprises me is not just that they're breaking it down by the hour just in terms of, like, for this story or for, you know, whatever. These kids really are hired on an hourly basis.
Yes, they are.
We never were hired on an hourly basis. We made $350 a week.
Right, and we only started getting overtime once somebody, some assistant said, I'm leaving the industry, I don't care, I'm suing you. And he or she sued ICM, International Creative Management, won, and it scared all of the other agencies into giving overtime pay.
My boss still wouldn't give me overtime.
Yeah, you write that in your article. And what I love is that he started giving it to you once he found out that your family, your mother and father, were not supplementing your income.
Unbelievable, isn't it? He looked at me and he was like, don't your parents supplement your income? I'm like, no, I'm an adult. And it was funny because maybe a month after that, I realized that his own father supplemented his income. And I also knew that he was making 250 grand. So the fact that he was making 250 grand a year and his dad was supplementing him and he wouldn't let an employee making 350 a week get some overtime? Come on!
Yeah, I thought what you wrote was absolutely correct, that this whole nepotistic society of agents and agents, the agency world is very kind of Beverly Hills kid driven. And when I worked at CAA, I finally got to move from the outside parking lot to the inside parking lot, which was very narrow. And I had this old, huge 1973 Dodge Dart, and I would drive it down into the parking garage. And I'd be very careful for the first, like, two levels, because those were all the agents' cars. Mm-hmm. And heaven forbid I hit one of those, I'd be working for them for the rest of my life and probably still not pay it off. But then I thought I had it, you know, I was in the clear once I got past the agents' cars. Absolutely not. All the assistants were driving BMWs. I mean, entry-level BMWs, mind you, but they were still driving these really expensive cars. And I can tell you that on $350, $400 a week, they weren't paying for a BMW or a Lexus.
No. And the reason why these kids drive these fancy cars is because they come from families where their parents are supplementing their income, which means they come from wealthy families. And, you know, I mean, I could name a million people that you and I both work with. We were one of the few people who lived off of the $350 a week. Everybody else came from wealthy families who supplemented their income, and they drove BMWs, and they had all the entitlement that went with it.
Right, and the reason this became a story this week was because Nikki Fink last week wrote a story about how the WMA assistants had to readjust their salary to meet the Endeavor assistants' pay point, which was lower.
Right, so they essentially got their salary cut, which is just complete BS. I mean,
oh God!
I wonder whether that's legal.
Well, it most certainly. I mean, people take pay cuts all the time.
Yeah, no, if you've put it that way, yeah. But just the reality of it is just, it's despicable. And then what I think was interesting, too, is that the people wrote in on Nikki's blog who were like, these kids are just lucky, and that one guy who was my favorite, who couldn't even spell, it was just like, this is typical entry-level stuff. You have to stop whining or winning, in his words, and just go back to mommy and daddy. It's like, come on. Really look at what these kids are making. I mean, yeah, some of them would go whining home to mommy and daddy, who would give them more money. But then there are people who can't go whining to mommy and daddy, you know? Mommy and daddy aren't going to help them.
Whether it's at an agency in Hollywood or a publishing company in New York, and possibly, I'm sure, Michael, you know, working in journalism, when you start out as a copy boy or a copy editor, you're really not paid very well. The base salary in publishing is $16,000 to $20,000. It might be a little more now, but these are jobs that don't pay very well because a lot of people want to do them to break into an industry. But the reality is those people are taken advantage of quite often.
When I got my first on-staff job at a magazine in the 90s, this was after working first as a volunteer, coming in for 2 days a week, and then a part-time person for 30 hours a week. And I finally got on staff. They offered me $18,000 a year. I had to keep working my second job on the weekends just to make ends meet. I still had to borrow money because I was living in New York City.
And you walked to work uphill in the snow both ways.
I did, yeah. And I got my job, and I had to work 7 days a week. I couldn't quit my little job in a deli because I couldn't afford to.
But now,
I needed the extra money on the weekends.
But now look
at
you,
Michael. Years. Now look where I am.
Now look where you are. You get to work for free on a podcast. You've come A long, long way, baby.
I'm building the brand. I'm building the brand.
That's right. I think that definitely is a sign that we should wrap up this week's show. For links to all of the stories we discussed on this episode, you can visit our website, which is at showbizsandbox.com, and you can look all of the links up in our show notes for this episode, episode 15. Our website is where you'll also find links to all of our social networking accounts. That includes Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. If you want to email us to tell us that you agree, disagree, or just happen to love us, you can do that. The email address to send your messages to is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can leave us a voicemail as well. You can call 888-567-SAND. That's toll-free, 888-567-7263. If you want to send us news stories, you can do so through the social bookmarking website Delicious. Just tag your links, Showbiz Sandbox, all one word. And we should note that the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each episode of Showbiz Sandbox is by the indie group MGMT. You can visit their website at whoismgmt.com or find them on MySpace at myspace.com/MGMT. If you want to see them in person, you can do so on August 15th at Dockville 2009 in Hamburg, Germany. And I guess we should also, we've plugged, Karen, your website, industrynexus.com. You can find Michael at michaelgiltz.com, but you can't find him on Twitter.
Yeah, not yet.
And Rolling Stone has a new article about MGMT and the recording of the new album, so hopefully you can find that at rollingstone.com.
Yes, well, I have to say that I've been wondering, every week I write, you know, where they're playing. They're always playing somewhere. I'm wondering when they're going to get back into the studio and record something.
Well, tell
them.
They already have. Well, guys, thank you very much. Until next week, play nice.